black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Monday, September 10th. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Morgan Yee. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on the website citr.ca.
Good evening. It is 5:04 and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world.
All this plus your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent news.
Also today we have your science segment, Simply Science by Sarah Chow, as well as your health segment, Dietetic Intuition, brought to you by our health team. And, yes, our weather forecast. And now for your local headlines.
UBC has planned an underground parking for the UBC bus loop for the center of campus. The facility, which is to be dug out underneath where the Aquatic Center currently sits, will house extra bus parking underground. Construction will start in 2015 and is expected to be finished by 2016. The new Aquatic Center will be built on top of the current McInnes Field, and when it is fully built in 2016, a new field will be put in to replace the current Aquatic Center. The loop where bus riders board buses will be moved slightly from its current location, taking the place of the parking lot that currently sits next to the War Memorial Gym. The plans for the location of the new bus loop and underground bus parking, as well as the new Aquatic Center and housing in place of the current bus loop, were decided upon by the Gage South Working Group, whose discussions drew to a close this summer. The timeline for the new parking lot will be heavily informed by the construction of the new Aquatic Center and the eventual demolition of the current one, according to Joe Stott, Director of Campus Planning. Stott also acknowledged that venting exhaust from buses driving underground is still a concern which UBC and TransLink need to address. Stott said, quote, "Exhaust will be addressed as part of the design process. It has been identified as a key issue. There are lots of examples of buildings on campus where we have rooftop vents, but what's needed for diesel exhaust has to be worked out in detail," end quote.
A new quote-unquote multi-service desk is being constructed on the third floor of the Irving K. Barber Learning Center. In the middle of an area previously reserved for study tables. The construction is slated to begin on September 17th, and it will occur during the day while the library is still open. Gordon Yusko, assistant director of IKB, said that, quote, "There will be some noise, but we're going to work with the construction crews to minimize that," end quote. The floor space available for study tables will be reduced, but Yusko stressed that the new desk will only take a quote-unquote limited footprint of the area. The desk will be designed to be a central resource for students seeking out any of the library's many amenities. Assistant Director Yusko said, quote, "The Learning Commons staff, the circulation staff, the reference staff will be brought together at one point so that students don't have to go floor to floor to access these services," end quote. Construction is scheduled to continue until December, and the new desk will open in January. Yusko said it is likely that the construction would continue into the December exam period. A similar centralized desk was completed in Kerner Library in July, and there are plans to build one in Woodward Library as well.
New ministers have been appointed to two positions that affect UBC after the BC Liberals announced a cabinet shuffle today. Bill Bennett was appointed Minister of Community, Sport and Cultural Development, taking Ida Chong's position. As UBC currently has no local government, land use for the campus ultimately falls under the responsibility of this ministry. This marks the fifth leadership change in 30 months over the UBC land portfolio. Bennett was previously in charge of the UBC land portfolio before being fired from cabinet in 2010. Minister of Advanced Education Naomi Yamamoto was dropped to a junior position, Minister of State for Small Businesses, and John Yap, previously the minister responsible for multiculturalism, will now preside over both of these portfolios as a Minister of Advanced Education, Innovation and Technology, and Minister responsible for multiculturalism. Yamamoto has been Minister of Advanced Education since Premier Christy Clark took office in March 2011.
Vancouver's eco-conscious Mayor Gregor Robertson has entered into the debate on BC's carbon tax, urging the province to not only keep it, but to begin directing revenues to municipalities for green initiatives such as public transit. The carbon tax is currently revenue neutral and applies to businesses and individuals. Every dollar collected is returned to taxpayers through reductions in other taxes, including credits for low-income households, business tax cuts, and benefits for northern and rural homeowners. In a letter submitted last month as part of BC's carbon tax review consultations, Mayor Robertson pressed the government to use the money generated for climate-friendly expenditures such as transit, renewable district energy, and building efficiency retrofits. Mayor Robertson said today, quote, "The carbon tax wasn't an appropriate vehicle for tax cuts. It should have always been focused on investing in transit and other climate-related investments," end quote. The tax, which was raised gradually, now adds about 7 cents to a liter of gasoline. The province plans to announce its plan for the tax in the next provincial budget this February.
Starting Monday, police incidents in British Columbia that end in fatalities or serious injury will be investigated by an outside agency. The Provincial Independent Investigations Office will open its doors, taking over reviews for incidents involving RCMP, 11 municipal police departments, provincial transit police, and one First Nations police force operating in the province. The office fulfills the primary recommendation from public inquiries into two high-profile police-involved deaths. Robert Jakansky died at Vancouver Airport in October 2007 after being stunned with an RCMP taser, and Frank Paul froze to death in a Vancouver alley where he was taken by Vancouver police after being ejected from the city drunk tank. BC Justice Minister Shirley Bond will officially open the office on Monday alongside IIO Director Richard Rosenthal. Bonds has said the office will strengthen the public's faith in police by ensuring that incidents of death or serious harm are investigated in an impartial way. In order to maintain impartiality, the government has stipulated that none of the investigators hired by the office can have served as a police officer in BC within the past 5 years. David Ebby of the BC Civil Liberties Association said his group, which has long advocated the creation of an independent watchdog, is glad to see this day finally arrive. The association would also like to see the IIO take over investigations of allegations of sexual assault against police officers. And David Ebby said they will be watching closely to see that police cooperate within the independent watchdog.
And those were your local headlines here on News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. It is now time for our health segment.
To your weekly health beat on CITR 101.9 FM.
It's Dietetic Intuition, your source for precise nutrition advice.
What are you going to hear? We'll bust nutrition myths, give tips, do book reviews, as well as interviews, you name it. And now here are your dietetic students, Andrea, Jessica, and Sharon, for this week's segment.
Hi everyone, this is Andrea and it is Monday. Thank you so much for joining us on such a beautiful afternoon. Today we'll be talking about breakfast. So September is Breakfast for Learning Month. The new school year has started up again just last week and we are so excited to have the opportunity to talk to you about why eating a healthy breakfast every day can help boost your academic performance in school. So why do we care? Why is it important to eat breakfast every day? Eating breakfast can help prevent those afternoon energy slumps. It can also increase your attention span, improve your concentration, perform better on spatial and cognitive tests, and that's just to mention a few of the many benefits. However, breakfast is also the most frequently skipped meal. Up to 30% of people regularly skip breakfast in the morning, with this percentage increasing with age and particularly amongst women. So what health impacts could skipping breakfast have on you? Aside from what was mentioned before, breakfast skippers have been shown to gain more weight than breakfast eaters. According to the National Weight Control Registry, 78% of people who lose weight and keep it off eat breakfast every day. Breakfast skippers tend to snack more on sugary, fatty foods during the day in between meals to keep their energy levels up, and they are more likely to overeat at lunch due to excessive hunger, which is why this is the case. So overall, skipping breakfast can lead to unintentional weight gain in the long run, which is something you may want to prevent. So now I'll pass it on to Jess, who's going to talk to you about fiber and whether it should be something you should be including in your breakfast every day.
Okay, so what about fiber? Is it something you should be eating every day for breakfast? So fiber is something we've covered in previous segments and is definitely something you should aim to include in your breakfast every day. So the benefits of eating enough fiber every day include staying regular, lowering blood cholesterol, and regulating blood sugar levels, just to name a few. Fiber intake has been shown to decrease significantly throughout the day, so breakfast is the ideal opportunity to make sure you get enough fiber in your diet overall. Fiber recommendations for adult men are 38 grams per day and 25 grams per day for women. So this may seem like a lofty goal, but eating enough fiber can be achieved in a variety of ways. It may not necessarily involve eating bowl after bowl of lentils, for example. There are many breakfast products in the market that are very high in fiber. Oatmeal, bran cereals, and whole grain breads are available, just to name a few. So if we put together this breakfast, we can calculate how much fiber you're going to get out of it, for example. So say you take one cup of oatmeal, that's about 4 grams of fiber. A medium-sized apple with the skin on is about 4 grams of fiber. And 2 tablespoons of raisins, that's 1 gram of fiber. If you have all three for breakfast, that would be 9 grams of fiber. To put this into perspective, if you're an adult woman requiring 25 grams of fiber per day, that's almost already 20% of your daily fiber intake. If you're looking to add more fiber in your breakfast, there are many online databases that list foods according to fiber content. So check out our blog following the segment for the link. The link to food consumption databases, including all macronutrients, which is your fat, your protein, and your carbohydrates, micronutrients, such as your vitamins and your minerals, as well as fiber, can be found on a simple app for your iPhone, for example. It's called the Nutrients Canada app, so you should check it out.
Hi, everyone. So just to make this a bit more practical, we're going to talk about some healthy options for your breakfast. So a general rule of thumb is to aim to have about 3 out of 4 food groups for breakfast to ensure that you're meeting your nutritional requirements throughout the day. So if you get off to a good start, you're much more likely to meet your requirements. And you want to choose foods that are high in whole grains, fruit, dairy products, meat products, anything you can. And just variety is a great way to start. So some examples, though, that we're going to provide is that breakfast should really be higher in protein and fiber to help you get started on the right foot. And that's because protein digests more slowly and will help you stay fuller longer. And same with fiber. So if you can get a significant portion of that in earlier, you might be able to last longer throughout the day. So some ideas, though, is oatmeal with soy milk and dried fruit of your choice. You can try bagel with low-fat cream cheese or peanut butter. How about yogurt with sliced fruit? And then if you want to bump up your your protein from there, maybe add some almonds or walnuts in there as well. And then toasted whole wheat English muffin with lean ham and low-fat cheese. That whole wheat portion of the English muffin will also have a couple grams of fiber. And then you can try toasted pita with scrambled egg and low-fat cheese. And then if you wanted to just keep your saturated fat intake in check, you can try spreading or brushing olive oil on toast rather than butter. And so in conclusion, we just want to point out that breakfast is a very important meal of the day. And in addition to refueling your body after an 8 to 10 hour fast while you're sleeping, eating breakfast can also improve your school performance by increasing your ability to concentrate and your attention span throughout the day. So consider having a healthy breakfast every day if possible. And then again, we did say that it's good to aim for 3 food groups in your breakfast, and don't forget to include as much fiber and protein as possible. But we want to emphasize that we know everybody is busy and it's hard to get it in all the time. So if you're really strapped, it's best to just at least have something rather than nothing and keep yourself, going for that perfect lunchtime or something. So if you can keep some granola bars or nuts and snacks at your desk, that's great. And then even maybe look into getting some meal replacements where you can just add a glass of milk or something like that. So that's
sometimes is a good option. So thank you very much, and we'll have some resources on our blog after the segment.
Thanks for tuning in again this week.
If you missed us, please go to blogs.ubc.ca/dietetics intuition or follow us on Twitter at CITR Health, and even like us on Facebook at Dietetics Intuition. Until next time, stay happy and healthy, Vancouver.
We thank the health team for that segment on breakfast. You are listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. We are going to take a quick break, but do stay with us for your local weather forecast by Phil, who's right here in our studio, and your provincial and national headlines.
Hi, this is Mikhail Tank. Check out my new show, The Power of Rejection, at the Vancouver Fringe Festival this coming September. For more information, go to vancouverfringe.com and mikhailtank.com.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM. I am Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Morgan Yee. Thank you for being with us. We now have your local weather forecast for the week, brought to you by Phil from the UBC Storm Club.
Hi, Phil.
Hi, CJ. Hi, Morgan. Thanks for having me. Well, listeners, with the cold front largely behind us now, atmospheric conditions will definitely be less dynamic than it was yesterday and this morning. Our models are showing a gradual trend towards decreasing cloudiness over the next 3 days, which affirms and supports Environment Canada's very exciting forecast of sunny all week. I think a large part of their rationale is banking on that an upcoming high pressure cell will sustain over the Pacific Ocean and deter all the dynamic weather away. It's good reasoning, and this is very likely to happen from what we see now. So hopefully that's how events will unfold. One thing to note, though, if you're a UBC student, is we could be getting a bit of onshore flow by the waterside over these next few days. So temperatures for UBC campus could be as much as 2 or 3 degrees colder than the overall predicted. So just something to keep in mind before heading off to class. Great. Now here is Environment Canada's Vancouver forecast for this week. Tonight, partly cloudy, 30% chance of showers early this morning, becoming windy this evening, low of 8. Tuesday, mainly sunny, high of 18, UV index of 5 or moderate. Tuesday night, partly cloudy, becoming clearer in the evening, low of 9. Wednesday, sunny, high of 19, 23 inland. Thursday, sunny, low of 11, high of 21, 25 inland. And Friday, sunny, low of 12, high of 21 and 25 inland. So, great. Thanks for listening in. That was your weekday weather summary. Reporting for News 101, I'm Phil Chang from the UBC Storm Club. Back to you guys.
Thank you, Phil. I'm glad to hear that. In more weather news, I don't know if you'd like to comment on this, but the sheets of heavy rain have swamped two Nova Scotia rivers, leading to flooding and evacuations in Colchester County as Tropical Storm Leslie churns towards Atlantic Canada. So, Phil, have you heard about Tropical Storm Leslie?
Yes, I have, actually.
It's heading towards Nova Scotia now. And apparently water levels in the rivers in Nova Scotia are rising starting today and will continue for the next few days. So Bob Taylor, the mayor of the municipality of County Colchester, says dikes in both rivers gave way, flooding some roads in and out of Truro and the village of Bible Hill. Taylor says some people have been asked to voluntarily leave their homes, but only a few have chosen to do so. He says a high school near Salmon River was evacuated before lunchtime as a precaution. So the Canadian Hurricane Center says up to 100 millimeters of rain is expected over eastern mainland Nova Scotia by Tuesday. Is that an above average amount? Like, Phil, would you defend on the local?
To be honest, I am not a specialist on the East Coast side of things, but definitely I think the Hurricane Center in Nova Scotia, they have lots of experience. They are the most experienced in all of Canada in terms of hurricanes.
True.
They get that a lot.
That's true. And this report also says that the storm circulation is 800 kilometers in diameter, and so they expect the effects to be widespread. And that was Phil with our weather update. Back to you, Morgan.
So we've got a story about the Peachland fires now. The strong winds that sent a fire barreling towards this lakefront community in British Columbia's Okanagan proved too much for firefighters attempting to keep the blaze away from homes, with gusts of wind acting like flamethrowers and destroying four houses. The fire, which started Sunday near Peachland and moved 3 kilometers in little more than an hour, continued to send thick clouds of white smoke over the community Monday, with more than 1,500 residents under an evacuation order. Three homes and an abandoned house were destroyed, fire officials said, along with several outbuildings in the northern and western edges of town. No one was injured. Peachland's fire chief, Grant Topham, said in an interview Monday, quote, "The wind was blowing very hard in that area. We had the crews in there and they saved many, many homes. The wind blew the fire into those homes. They tried to save them as best they could. They tried their best. They saved many homes, but unfortunately, there were some they could not, did not save," end quote. Hundreds more people remain on evacuation alert.
The Canadian mining giant Teck Resources Limited has admitted in a U.S. court that effluent from its smelter in southeast British Columbia has polluted the Columbia River in Washington State for more than a century. Teck subsidiary Teck Metals made the admission of fact in a lawsuit brought by a group of American Indian tribes over environmental damage caused by the effluent discharges dating back to 1896. The agreement, which reached on the eve of the trial initiated by the Colville Confederated Tribes, stipulates that some hazardous materials in the slag discharged from Teck's smelter in Trail, BC, ended up in the upper Columbia River south of the border. Teck said the agreement is expected to lead to a court judgment in favor of the plaintiffs. However, the court has yet to decide the extent of any injuries that may have resulted, and what, if any, damages the company will have to pay. The lawsuit brought by the Colville tribes 8 years ago was to begin on Monday. They claimed Teck dumped 145,000 tons of slag containing arsenic, cadmium, copper, mercury, lead, and zinc directly into the Columbia River. They claim those wastes have contaminated the surface water, groundwaters, and sediments of the upper Columbia River and Lake Roosevelt, the reservoir created by the Grand Coulee Dam. The Colville Reservation of almost 5,700 square kilometers borders the Columbia River. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency joined the lawsuit as an intervener. The cost of cleaning up the contamination has been pegged as high as $1 billion, and the state, Washington State that is, wants Teck to bear that cost.
The Canadian Radio, Television and Telecommunications Commission has reopened public consultations on the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation's upcoming television and radio license renewal. Hearings on CBC Radio Canada's license renewal will begin November 19th in Gatineau, Quebec. The deadline to submit interventions and answers is October 5th, and the broadcaster must respond to them by October 15th. CBC's license renewal hearings were originally scheduled for September 2011, but were postponed in order to give the broadcaster sufficient time to gather data the CRTC needed, as well as figure out its future operating budget. The hearings were then scheduled to take place in June 2012, but once again were postponed as the federal budget loomed and CBC faced uncertainty as to its funding moving forward. The federal government slashed CBC's budget by $115 million over 3 years in its budget released in March. A further financial challenge to the broadcaster is CRTC's recent decision to phase out the Local Programming Improvement Fund over the next 2 years. CBC received $40 million annually from the fund, which was spread out among 20 stations. When asked in an interview with J Source, CBC Vice President and Chief Regulatory Officer Stephen Guiton would not comment on any specific changes that may come to those recipient stations in the absence of LPIF funds. The BC government has hired a former attorney general to oversee the province's grilling of Enbridge on its proposed Northern Gateway pipeline project. Premier Christy Clark says Jeff Plant will lead the province's legal team during the cross-examination of the company at the joint review panel hearings currently underway in Edmonton and follow-up hearings in BC. She says Plant is one of the best legal minds in the country and will help BC get the answers it needs about the proposal to build the pipeline from Alberta to a tanker port in Kitimat. Clark says the impact of the pipeline is vital to British Columbians and there's no price that can be put on environmental protection. Plant says the cross-examination in Edmonton will focus on Enbridge's financial and corporate capacity to deal with oil spills, while the later hearings in Prince George and Prince Rupert will focus on technical questions involving the handling of spills on land and at sea. He says the hearings are an important opportunity to ask the questions that British Columbians want answered. And those are your provincial and national headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned to your weekday... Oh, no, we already had that. Stay tuned to us. International headlines. We had some quick PSAs, and we will be right back.
CITR 101.9 FM presents Nardwar's Video Vault 2.0. Join Nardwar the Human Serviette live as he digs through his video and audio vault of interviews. Plus, you can meet the staff and volunteers at CITR and find out how you can get involved. The event is free and takes place on September 10th from 6 to 8 p.m. in the Norm Theater in the UBC Student Union Building.
Please come out and do-do-da-loot-do!
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM. I am your host, Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Morgan Yee.
And it is now time for our science segment by Sarah Chow. This is Simply Science.
This is Simply Science, bringing you your science news. I'm Sarah Chow. In Canada, the average age of first-time mothers is 29.6 years, which is a big increase from 21.4 years in the 1970s. Having babies at a later age can be dangerous for both the mother and the baby. Older mothers are more likely to develop chronic illnesses like high blood pressure and are at a greater risk of having babies with birth defects like Down syndrome. However, they are not the only ones to blame for children born with genetic disorders. Men also play a role. As men age, their risk of sperm DNA damage increases. This could cause genetic mutations that they then pass down to their offspring, leading to disorders like dwarfism. However, researchers at the University of California, Berkeley may have the answer to revitalizing sperm DNA in older men. And the secret is in the diet. They found men older than 44 years who consume at least the recommended dietary allowance of vitamin C, vitamin E, zinc, and folate had 20% less sperm DNA damage compared to those who consumed less. In fact, their DNA quality was comparable to those of younger men. So what's so special about these micronutrients? Well, they have antioxidant properties that protect DNA damage in cells, which causes genetic disorders. So men, make sure you keep up your intake of vitamin C, E, zinc, and folate, which can be found in oranges, nuts, garlic, and beans, to keep up your sperm DNA. Seminal fluid has long been thought to just be lube for semen,
But research has found it actually contains a protein that induces females to ovulate. In fact, this protein could explain those oopsie babies couples have. Now, most female animals are spontaneous ovulators, meaning they release an egg at regular intervals regardless of sexual activity, like the way humans do. But there are other species, like rabbits, camels, and llamas, that are induced ovulators, meaning they release eggs in response to sex. It was long thought it was due to the physical stimulation of sex that triggers ovulation. But Dr. Greg Adams at the University of Saskatchewan found a protein called OIF, or ovulation-induced factor in seminal fluid, is the true culprit for inducing ovulation. But wait, this story gets even more interesting. This protein is the same protein involved in regulating growth, maintenance, and survival of nerve cells called NGF, or nerve growth factor. Strange, eh? This is the first evidence that NGF travels from the semen to the female body, triggering hormones to induce ovulation. Now, although humans are not induced ovulators, NGF still has fertility-boosting effects, such as promoting female ovaries to maintain pregnancy. So, the moral of the story, always use protection because accidents do happen. Now, here's another way to prevent oopsie babies from happening and gives men more control in the baby-making process. It's the male birth control pill. Yes, the elusive male birth control pill has been found, but it's not in stores just yet. A group of researchers in the U.S. found a molecule called JQ1 that not only inhibits sperm production, it also stops them from swimming, which are two characteristics necessary for fertilization. But don't worry, this molecule won't keep men sterile forever. It's reversible, and it won't dampen their mojo either. Researchers injected mice with JQ1 and found they were as frisky as usual, but were sterile. When they stopped the injections, reproductive rates returned to normal. What's even more interesting is that unlike the female pill that sometimes interferes with hormones like estrogen, researchers are confident that the male pill won't affect testosterone levels. So men need not worry about growing boobs or having high-pitched voices. That's it for this week for Simply Science. For CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, British Columbia, I'm Sarah Chow.
And thank you to Sarah Chow for that science segment, Simply Science. If you want to listen to it again, you can check out our website, citr.ca/news, and listen to it on our Mixcloud page.
Or our Facebook page. It'll be there, too.
That's right. All right. And that does it for your local, national, provincial, and national headlines. We now go to international headlines by Democracy Now!
The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. More than 100 people were killed in Iraq Sunday on one of the country's deadliest days this year. A series of bombings hit Baghdad shortly after fugitive Iraqi Vice President Tariq Hashemi was sentenced to death for allegedly planning and funding attacks in Iraq. A leading Sunni Muslim politician, Hashemi fled Baghdad in December when Iraq's Shia-led government accused him of running death squads. Hashemi has denied the charges, saying they're politically motivated. The controversy around Hashemi has sparked fears of worsening the sectarian turmoil between Shiites and Sunnis. In Sunday's worst attack, more than 50 people were killed when a bomb struck a crowded commercial area. The U.S. has formally handed control of the Bagram Air Base to the Afghan government in a key milestone for the more than decade-long NATO occupation. But despite the handover, the U.S. is continuing to retain control over several dozen prisoners in a dispute with the Afghan government. The New York Times reports the spat apparently centers on Afghan refusals to adopt the no-trial detention system demanded by the U.S. government. Scores of Syrian government forces have been killed in a double bombing in the besieged city of Aleppo. Residents and activists say the bombs targeted makeshift barracks housing soldiers stationed in Aleppo to root out opposition fighters. Syrian state media says at least 17 soldiers were killed and 40 wounded. Speaking at the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit in Russia, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said the U.S. continues support for the Syrian opposition.
We haven't seen eye to eye with Russia on Syria. That may continue. And if it does continue, then we will work with like-minded states to support the Syrian opposition, to hasten the day when Assad falls, and to help prepare Syria for a democratic future and, help it get back on its feet again. There's no point to passing a resolution with no teeth, because we've seen time and time again that Assad will ignore it and keep attacking his own people.
President Obama hit the campaign trail over the weekend after a new round of job numbers underscored his challenge to overcome a struggling economy in order to win re-election. The Labor Department reported Friday the economy added 96,000 jobs last month, a lower number than had been predicted. The official unemployment rate saw a slight dip to 8.1%, but only because less people reported they were actively looking for work. Speaking in New Hampshire, President Obama urged supporters to back his call for tax cuts only for those making $250,000 below.
Today we learned that after losing around 800,000 jobs a month when I took office, business once again added jobs for the 30th month in a row, a total of more than 4.6 million jobs. But that's not good enough. We know it's not good enough. We need to create more jobs faster. We need to fill the hole left by this recession faster. We need to come out of this crisis stronger than when we went in. And there's a lot more that we can do. You know, when Congress gets back to town next week, you need to send them a message. Go ahead and give middle-class families and small businesses the confidence of knowing that their taxes, your taxes, will not go up next year.
Campaigning in Virginia Saturday, Republican nominee Mitt Romney seized on the latest job figures to paint Obama as weak on the economy.
This president has not fulfilled his promises. And then he went to the Democrat convention and spoke at great length and had a lot of wonderful things to say. But he didn't say what he'd do to help people get jobs or come out of unemployment, or to get people that are poor back to the middle class. He doesn't have a plan. He doesn't have any ideas. And we got to make sure he doesn't have any more days in the White House after January.
Over 25,000 Chicago public school teachers have gone on strike for the first time in 25 years. The teachers are walking off the job after union leaders failed to reach agreement with the nation's third largest school district over education reforms sought by Mayor Rahm Emanuel. We'll have more on the strike after headlines. The Obama administration's drawing controversy for siding with two former Latin American leaders in unrelated cases involving the massacres of civilians. The White House has informed Bolivia it won't extradite former President Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada to face charges over the mass killing of Bolivian protesters in 2003. At least 64 civilians were slain, more than 400 wounded, when the Bolivian military cracked down on protests that sparked an uprising against De Lozada's government. He has been indicted in Bolivia, but has not been tried because he's been living safely in exile in the United States ever since. On Friday, Bolivian President Evo Morales said the Obama administration had rejected Bolivia's extradition request on the grounds a civilian leader cannot be tried for a military's crimes. Morales blasted the decision, calling the U.S. a paradise of impunity.
No es posible que diga mediante una carta.
The U.S. can't send a letter saying civil society can't be responsible for military actions. I reject these claims. I do not agree. This is a pretext for the U.S. to turn into a haven for delinquents, a paradise of impunity. It is easy for us to see that a country that has never respected the dignity and sovereignty of Latin America can't extradite someone who's done so much harm to the Bolivian people and works for the American empire.
To to see a full interview with President Morales, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. In a separate move, the U.S. government has filed a court briefing declaring former Mexican President Ernesto Zedillo enjoys immunity from a Connecticut civil suit for alleged war crimes. The suit accuses Zedillo of responsibility for a 1997 massacre in the Chiapas village of Acteal, when government-backed paramilitary groups killed 45 people as part of an attempt to quash the Zapatista popular uprising. Zedillo now lives in Connecticut and teaches at Yale University. Lawyers for the plaintiffs say they'll be forced to drop the case as a result of Zedillo's immunity. Clashes have erupted in the Chilean capital of Santiago ahead of Tuesday's 39th anniversary of the U.S.-backed overthrow of President Salvador Allende. On September 11, 1973, Allende died in the presidential palace in the coup that brought Augusto Pinochet to power. On Sunday, Chilean police fired tear gas while protesters commemorating Pinochet's victims set up barricades and threw Molotov cocktails. Protests are continuing against the U.S.-backed regime in Bahrain in the face of an ongoing crackdown on government opponents. On Friday, Bahraini forces fired tear gas and stun grenades at demonstrators who defied a ban on unauthorized protests. The rally was held to call for the freedom of scores of Bahraini political prisoners after a military court upheld the convictions of 20 activists last week. The demonstrators managed to join together despite government attempts to block them from joining up in the capital, Manama. Bahrain is a key U.S. government ally hosting the Navy's Fifth Fleet. And new figures show the U.S. is on pace to approach the record number of deportations of undocumented immigrants seen last year. The Department of Homeland Security says it's deported 366,000 people with just 1 month left in fiscal 2012. Nearly 392,000 immigrants were deported in fiscal 2011, despite illegal border crossings of migrants dropping to a 40-year low. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And thank you to Amy Goodman for those international headlines. We are going to take a quick break, but do stay with us for more international headlines brought to you by Free Speech Radio News.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
And welcome back to News 101. I'm Morgan Yee. For more international headlines, we're going to listen to Free Speech Radio News.
Delays due to safety and environmental concerns, Shell Oil has started drilling operations off the Alaskan coast. But because their spill response ship, Arctic Challenger, is not yet ready or in position, the Department of the Interior only granted them a permit for an exploratory well and won't yet allow them to go after the zones estimated to have the most oil. And since it's late in the season, they'll only be able to install some infrastructure and equipment for the oil well in the Chukchi Sea over the next few weeks before they have to shut down and wait for next summer's ice melt to continue drilling. This comes as new data from the National Snow and Ice Data Center finds that Arctic sea ice is at its lowest level since satellite recordings began, with several weeks of summer melting yet to come. Travis Nichols with Greenpeace said Shell is just one of several companies gearing up to profit from resources and waterways newly exposed by the shrinking ice caps.
It's just terrifying to think that you'd want to use catastrophe on this magnitude to make a quick buck.
Scientists at the National Snow and Ice Data Center report that within a few decades, there could be completely ice-free summers at the Northern Pole. In this context, Nichols says the environmental concerns that have dogged Shell since it secured the drilling lease in 2008 remain unresolved.
They put forward emission standards that they agreed to with the Obama administration and the EPA, and then when they actually decided that they were going forward, they said, well, we can't meet these EPA standards that we agreed to, can we meet lesser standards? And they also said their spill response vessels could meet certain seaworthiness standards put forward by the Department of the Interior. And once they actually started going up there, they said, well, actually, we can't meet those standards. How about we meet these looser or lesser standards? And so far, the Obama administration has said that that's fine, which establishes a very dangerous precedent going forward.
Greenpeace activists say shrinking sea ice and growing drilling and mining is a threat to the region's wildlife, including seals, whales, and carabao. This in turn impacts the Inupiat and other native communities that depend on hunting and fishing for subsistence. Nichols added that those who live far from the region are also feeling the effects of the loss of the ice caps, but often don't make the connection.
The Arctic can seem like a remote region and something that's far away from our everyday lives, but as we can see from this summer, that when it's melting up there, it's burning here, and the extreme weather events that we've had are inexorably linked to what goes on in the Arctic, because the way the Arctic works is that it cools the rest of the planet, and so when you have the sea ice melting, you're making global warming and the extreme weather that we see in the lower 48 and across the globe that much worse.
As they consult with indigenous Alaskans about protest and lobbying efforts in the months ahead, Greenpeace members will go to the UN General Assembly in New York next week to call on the international body to intervene in what they call a polar emergency. The wave of protests against high prices continues in the West Bank for a second week. The entire West Bank came to a standstill as public transportation drivers and shop owners launched a strike in the early morning. This came after Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas said over the weekend that the government did not have enough funds to pay employees full salaries this month. FSRN's Ghassan Banora reports.
Dozens of youth gathered in Bethlehem City Sunday night in one of the latest protests against government officials. Holding handmade signs, demonstrators called on the Palestinian Prime Minister Salam Fayyad and his government to resign. One sign read, "Fayyad, this is Bethlehem, not Paris." Monday morning, truck and taxi drivers blocked main roads all over the West Bank, protesting high prices of fuel and food in the Palestinian territories. Ahmed Isa is a taxi driver from Bethlehem.
We went on strike because of the high price of fuel. I drive a diesel car and it's $2 a liter. So at the end of the day, all of the income we make goes to fuel. We hope the government and the Ministry of Transportation listens to our demands and lowers the prices.
The Palestinian government promised to work fast to lower the prices in the West Bank, but the real problem, as seen by many, lies with the agreements officials in Ramallah signed with Tel Aviv. According to those agreements, the Palestinian Authority has to buy fuel from Israel at rates the average Palestinian can't afford. Additionally, the Palestinian government raised taxes on essential food products in order to offset its budget shortfall. Youth organizers are demanding immediate lowering of taxes and prices, but they also want a change in policies. George Shmawi is an organizer in Beit Sahur town, a suburb of Bethlehem City.
We need to have a solution where lowering prices, lowering fuel prices that affecting all the prices, and to have a much better economic solutions that what's really than what we are facing right now, less taxes on everything. That is basically the entire thing.
While most protests so far have been nonviolent, pro-government youth attacked taxi drivers in one incident Monday in Bethlehem City. The police arrived at the scene and separated the two sides, and no injuries were reported. Organizers say protests will continue until demands are met. Ghassan Banmura, FSRN, Bethlehem.
Parliamentary elections take place this week in the Netherlands, where the leader of the Socialist Party is growing in popularity. Supporters say Emile Roemer appeals to them because of his promises to protect the welfare state and his party's consistent skepticism towards further European integration. If he wins, it would be a first in Dutch history. FSRN's Peter Teffer reports from Arnhem, the Netherlands.
It is one of the hottest days of the year here in the Netherlands, and members of the Dutch Socialist Party are celebrating their kickoff for the election campaign at the Open Air Museum in Arnhem. The socialists have a reason to be cheerful. Opinion polls have put them at the front of the race, along with the VVD, the Liberal Party of current Prime Minister Mark Rutte. Some polls predict the socialists could more than double their current number of 15 seats in parliament. Historically, political parties in the Netherlands haven't won a majority of votes, so as a consequence, the country's governments have always consisted of coalitions. The party that wins the most seats in the elections has the right to start coalition talks, and usually provides the prime minister. So party leader Emil Roemer now has a fair chance of becoming the Netherlands' first socialist prime minister. In an interview with FSRN, Roemer says that he is ready to lead.
Obviously, I want a coalition with left-wing parties. And if that's not possible, I will try a center-left coalition. And if that's not possible, I will try to work together with others to pursue a social agenda that's as left-wing as possible. I want to take responsibility. I think it's our turn to receive that trust.
We deserved it.
Many national media are portraying the elections as a horse race between socialist leader Roemer and current Prime Minister Mark Rutte, leader of the economically liberal but socially conservative People's Party for Freedom and Democracy, known by its Dutch acronym VVD. Outside the building where Roemer was conducting interviews, scores of rank-and-file members of the Socialist Party walk amongst the open-air museum's historical Dutch buildings. The socialists are easily recognizable amongst regular museum visitors thanks to their red t-shirts. Frank Marchese, a 20-year-old student, explains why he has become a member of the party.
It's my father and most of my family were member of the Socialist Party. But also because I can see the negative effect of our current heading in Dutch politics. I've seen for myself how our healthcare has been torn apart, our educational system has been turned to shreds.
In a recent poll, 63% of voters listed healthcare as one of their most important issues. Others included the economic crisis, education, crime and the European Union. When right-wing politician Geert Wilders withdrew his support for the minority government last spring, effectively causing parliamentary elections, he called on the Dutch people to let these elections be a referendum on EU membership. However, Wilders and his Freedom Party aren't the only skeptics of European integration. Socialists are too, explains Dennis de Jong, a party member in the European Parliament.
I can imagine if you look at Europe from the United States point of view, you say, well, why don't these countries come together and just join? But for European citizens, it's extremely difficult to jump from our national identity to something like a European identity, which never existed.
However, de Jong says the Socialist Party is milder on the topic of European integration than the Freedom Party.
On policy issues, it's, for me, in the European Parliament, impossible to work together with people from the Wilders Party. And if you hear them about the European Parliament, they also only want to abolish it, they want to do away with it, they want to quit the European Union. You can't take that seriously.
The biggest problem at the moment is of course, with the crisis and the European Union going on right now.
That's another rank-and-file party member, 21-year-old student Emmy van Gemert. She supports the Socialist Party's plans for more redistribution of wealth.
I really think the people that have the most, you know, that eat the biggest part of the cookie, the financial cookie, should, well, do a little more. That's what solidarity is about.
In recent years, voters have moved more to the flanks of the political spectrum. Traditionally popular center parties like the Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats have seen their numbers of followers shrink. Many voters are still undecided about what party to vote for. 52-year-old Erik Roberts will vote for a left or center-left party, but is unsure if that will be the Socialist Party.
Maybe they are too extreme in their left ideas sometimes. For example, their ideas about Europe.
Although the party has its roots in the Maoist movement of the 70s, it's much more moderate now, says political scientist John Tilly of the University of Amsterdam.
And they're completely transformed into a social democratic party in a way. That's why the classical socialist democratic party, Partij van de Arbeid, needs to worry because the Socialist Party really took over their role.
More than 12 million people are eligible to vote in the September 12th poll. They'll get to choose from 21 parties on the ballot. Peter Zeffer, FSRN, Arnhem, the Netherlands.
And thank you to Free Speech Radio for bringing us those international headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at their website, fsrn.org. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca.
And that's our program for Monday, September 10th. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews on our website, citr.ca/news, or check out our Facebook page, CITR News 101. For more independent news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Morgan Yee.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. Today's show was produced by myself.
What a guy.
And Morgan Yee. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. And if you are on campus, please come down to the Nardwuar's Video Vault at Woo! The Norm Theatre. It's a free event and it's starting now. Up next, we've got Sore Throats Clapping Hands with your host, Robert, right here on CITR 101.9 FM.